Welcome to Translating Aging, a podcast about how the science of human longevity is transforming the way we treat disease. In each episode, we bring you conversations with the researchers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who are working at the vanguard of the field. Translating Aging is produced by BioAge Labs, a clinical stage biotechnology company that is harnessing the biology of human aging to develop novel targets and therapies for metabolic diseases. I'm Chris Patil, VP of Media at BioAge. Joining us today is Daisy Robinson, PhD, CEO and a co-founder of Oviva Therapeutics, a biotech startup developing first-in-class therapeutics to improve ovarian function and extend female health span. Dr. Robinson has a PhD from Harvard University and did her postdoc at Boston Children's Hospital. She co-founded Oviva in 2021 with the goal of addressing a vast unmet need in women's health by targeting ovarian physiology. Daisy, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with your personal journey. What led you as a researcher in neuroimmunology to focus on women's health and pivot in that direction to found Oviva Therapeutics?
Like many people who enter this space, and actually many people who enter science generally, it was informed by personal experience. I spent the vast majority of my academic career studying molecular and developmental biology. I've always loved the intersection of how a sperm and an egg fertilize and go on to form humans through the magical orchestration of cell differentiation and cell division, and then how that intersects with aging and disease pathology. That's really the lens that I've built over time. And so there happened to be a moment of serendipity in my personal life where I had decided to leave academia. I wasn't entirely certain how I wanted to deploy my passion and interests and skills after that, but it happened to coincide with, in my personal life, ending a significant relationship that prompted me to explore my fertility and want to understand more about my own physiology so that I can make decisions about, you know, whether or not to freeze eggs and how to pursue the life that I wanted on the personal side. That experience showed me and really underscored what I didn't actually know at the time, and I don't think was widely known at the time, how underserved the women's health space has been for essentially all of time. It was then that I learned not only how ignorant I was as a woman who holds a PhD in human biology, but also just more broadly, the world. We've spent most of our time studying male animals and biomedical research. We've spent most of our resources and clinical studies focused on male physiology. And so the way that we understand the human body and health and disease and diagnosis and treatment is generally speaking in the context of a male physiology. So at that moment in time, I did a deep dive to better understand the space of women's health, partly to be an informed person who could advocate for my own health and desires, but also just out of disappointment, I guess, and rage that we didn't have more information and data on women so that we could better care for women and better understand female health. And that aligned really well with the background that I brought from developmental and aging biology. And I got very interested in this fact that ovaries, which, you know, women who are born XX will have ovaries, they stop working well about halfway through our lives. And 100 years ago, this didn't really matter because life expectancy was about 56 and average onset of menopause is about 52. And so there wasn't really a huge delta there. But in today's day and age, we're living into our 80s and women are spending 42% of their lives postmenopausally and having significant declines and detriment to their health. So that's something I recognized at that moment just from my own deep dive into the space, being motivated by a random appointment I had with a reproductive endocrinologist after a breakup. And through a few turns of serendipity, it led me here, which is a much shorter and easier way of putting it than what happened, of course. But that's really what pivoted me into this, was a recognition of the huge need and the match that I have in my skills and passion to do something about it.
Thank you for synthesizing all those experiences and sharing them with us. I want to drill down on something that you mentioned. I think that a lot of people, and until recently, myself included, I was brought around to the right side by people like you and Jen Garrison. We think of menopause primarily being the end of reproductive life. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's become clear from hearing you speak at conferences and talking to other women in the field is ovarian health is really also about overall health span, not just whether you can have a pregnancy, but how long and how well you live. So could you just say a bit more about the link between ovarian health and overall health and longevity in women?
Yes. And thank you for that question, because I think this is something that's, as you mentioned, not widely known, not widely appreciated. And Jen, actually, Dr. Garrison really has, in my view, like the best way of putting this. She often will say that ovaries are the architects of health for women. And I couldn't agree more. I think that the ovaries really sit at the center of a signaling network that touches many different systems in our bodies that are essential for homeostasis or normal health and well-being for a woman. That includes brain health, heart health, immune function, sleep, bone health, of course. And what we know is that when a woman enters perimenopause and approaches menopause and starts having dysregulated hormones in her body, we see significantly increased risk of cardiovascular disease. We see neurocognitive decline, which often and most often manifests as brain fog for women, but also anxiety and depression spike at this time. We see that a lot of women have significant disturbance to their sleep. And I don't know if you've done an episode yet that covers sleep at all, but I think we are all increasingly appreciating how fundamental quality and quantity of sleep is to one's health.
I certainly appreciate it more and more as I get older, although we haven't actually covered it in the podcast.
Same. And certainly now that I have a toddler, I appreciate it even far more. But yeah, and there's other things too. You know, we know that there's dysregulated glucose metabolism and increased incidence of osteoporosis. So there's a whole long laundry list of health consequences that occur when ovaries no longer function. And that could be because you're going into menopause naturally or because it's induced through some other thing that's happened in your life. Like you have to do an oophorectomy where you take out your ovaries, or you have cancer treatment, which generally will send women into menopause through damage to the ovaries. And what's interesting, and this isn't directly answering your question, but what I think is really interesting is we also think of menopause as, like you said, the end of reproductive life, which is a very important inflection point and relevant. And there's something else I'd like to underscore there, which is that especially in today's day and age, that in and of itself is not important to all women. Many women want to be able to get pregnant and have healthy pregnancies later in life, but also there's many women who either don't want to have children or are done having children. So that is less of the inflection point at the fundamental day-to-day level than the decline in quality of life. And the other piece that I wanted to share is that, interestingly, we also know if you take out a woman's ovaries after menopause, she'll suffer more significant declines in her health than if you leave them intact. So there is something that they're doing postmenopausally that is important to our health and well-being. We don't really know what that is. And that's, we don't really know so much about how our ovaries work. So it's no surprise we don't know that either. But I think that's something that was a surprising learning for me in my journey was, we think of menopause as like the end of our ovaries working. No, they're still working. They're not allowing us to produce a healthy pregnancy. They're no longer producing hormones with the same regularity and levels that they have before, but there's something that they're contributing to in our health that's not particularly well understood. And I think that's very cool as well.
That's fantastic. So the TLDR is ovaries, not just for making babies, and ovaries still helping you after menopause.
Yes.
Those are both just critical learnings for me as well. And I really appreciate you summarizing everything so clearly. So moving now to what you're doing professionally as CEO of Oviva, I want to talk about the science that's underlying Oviva's lead program. But to do that, I think we might need a little remedial biology, probably for me, as certainly for some members of the audience. So for you, up for giving us a crash course in what follicles do.
Yes, thank you. So follicles, we don't hear follicles a lot. We think a lot about eggs and the ovaries and women having eggs. And we have what's called an ovarian reserve, which is however many eggs a woman might have at any given point in time. And the thing that houses the egg is the follicle. So the follicle is a structure in our ovary that houses the egg. So the egg sits inside. It's a structure that keeps the egg safe. It helps it mature when it's time. But importantly, the follicles are also the source of many of the reproductive hormones that regulate our health. And in that way, they are the fundamental unit underlying ovarian function. And they're really essential for ovarian function. So that's what a follicle is. And actually, maybe what I'll expand a little bit, which is to say that when a woman enters her reproductive years, so hits puberty, she starts activating follicles from that ovarian reserve where they're generally kept dormant. You'll start seeing roughly 1,000 of those, each containing a single egg, activated out of that ovarian reserve. And in doing so, it enters a maturation pathway. So you have a collection of follicles, each housing an egg that start maturing. They compete with one another. And ultimately, one of them will become a dominant follicle per cycle, per menstrual cycle, that will ovulate an egg. What's interesting, I think, about that, and what a lot of people don't know, is that you're not just losing one egg every month. You're losing about 1,000 every month during your reproductive years to produce one.
1,000?
Yes. So there's this huge attrition during a woman's reproductive years at a regular interval. And I think that's something essential to highlight, because that's really, it's one of the key facts that is linked to the approach that we are taking at Oviva, which is allowing us to retain ovarian reserve for a greater period of time by reducing how many eggs are lost with each menstrual cycle. So instead of losing 1,000, turning that down to 800 or 500 or 200, we don't know yet what the quote unquote right or optimal number might be, but we know that 1,000 is a lot. And there's certainly evidence to say you don't need 1,000 to create ovulation. And actually, most women, at least in America, are using some form of contraception to prevent ovulation. So the mechanism that we're deploying could be something that prevents ovulation while retaining ovarian reserve, which would be the only therapeutic available doing that. Current contraceptives available, whether it's birth control pills or IUDs or, you know, Depo-Vera or whatever, they all prevent ovulation or implantation of an egg. None of them do anything for the ovarian reserve. So you're losing 1,000 eggs a month if you're a woman with ovaries with every menstrual cycle that you undergo, regardless of contraceptive use.
Thank you very much for the biological context. I think that's going to really help us understand what comes next, which is Oviva is targeting a hormone called anti-Müllerian hormone, AMH. So could you just give us a little lesson in what role AMH plays in regulating ovarian reserve and how this relates to fertility and menopause?
AMH is a very cool protein, and it's really the last one standing, so to speak, in terms of reproductive hormones that have yet to have any therapeutic development. Obviously, we're all familiar with the birth control pill, which uses, you know, low doses currently of hormones to help regulate contraception, but also there's hormone therapy that women use when they're approaching menopause. AMH is the only one left that we know has a very powerful mechanism that doesn't yet have a therapeutic based on that mechanism, and that's what we're trying to solve for. So naturally, in a woman's body, because we know AMH is actually produced both in men and women, though we don't really understand what it's doing in men, but in a woman who is of reproductive age, AMH is produced and secreted by the growing follicles. So by the follicles that have been activated out of that dormancy and have started growing, they secrete AMH into their environment. And what happens with that is it actually acts as a suppressant or a brake on that first and earliest step of what we call folliculogenesis, how the follicles mature. It helps to prevent too many follicles from being activated at any given point in time. And in doing so, regulates how many of those follicles will depart the ovarian reserve at any given point in time. And a really nice way to sort of drive this home and illustrate its function is really looking at two extreme cases. The first being a woman who has high AMH levels. Oftentimes patients with PCOS will have high AMH. When you have high levels of AMH, that will suppress your ovarian reserve, prevent follicles from departing. And in the context of fertility or menopause, this can be bad for fertility because you're not necessarily getting the egg forward to maturation to ovulate, so it can prevent that. And we know that many women with PCOS do struggle with fertility. However, what could be thought of as a benefit is that you're retaining more of your ovarian reserve over time. And in doing so, you're extending your runway into menopause. So typically women with high AMH will enter menopause later. And that's true in the converse. We know that women who have low AMH tend to enter menopause earlier. So if you take another context where you see low AMH clinically, for example, women who are undergoing chemotherapy or radiation, those cancer treatments will damage growing follicles, which are the source of AMH in our bodies, which means you lose your naturally occurring endogenous AMH. And so there's nothing suppressing your dormant follicles from departing that ovarian reserve. When you lose that suppression, you get overactivation of those follicles. And so you deplete your eggs at a very rapid pace, and that accelerates your pace towards menopause. And so that's why women who have to have chemotherapy or radiation treatment will often go into menopause after treatment. Or women who just naturally, for whatever reason, might have low AMH, they'll have an accelerated depletion of their ovarian reserve and will enter menopause earlier.
Your first therapeutic candidate is an enhanced form of AMH that's aimed at improving outcomes for women undergoing fertility treatments like IVF. And could you explain how this treatment is intended to work?
Sure. And I'm glad for the opportunity to explain this because it can feel a little bit counterintuitive given that ultimately we want to retain eggs in the ovarian reserve, not expend them. However, what's really cool about how this protein works, how this hormone works in our bodies, and how we're planning to use it in the fertility context is you can essentially do a pulse of treatment, meaning you can do a short-term treatment where you can give a patient the drug, which is a recombinant form of AMH or an enhanced version of AMH. When they have that drug in their system, their ovarian reserve is protected. There's not as much departure of follicles from that ovarian reserve. What is also happening when that suppression is high, like in this therapeutic context, is that the follicles within the ovarian reserve start synchronizing. And those that are ready, quote unquote, ready to depart and activate and enter that maturation cycle, there's an accumulation of those. There's also a sort of stasis that occurs in the early stage follicles that are present. So what happens when you then remove the drug after that short pulse of treatment is you get a wave of follicles that enter the maturation cycle that are synchronized. And what's important about that is when a woman is undergoing IVF treatment, she starts with what's called ovarian hyperstimulation or ovarian stimulation. She'll take roughly 2 weeks of daily hormonal injections, which essentially acts to coax your body to produce and mature more than one egg so that you can harvest more than one egg, given the fact that typically we're only producing one mature egg per cycle. Ovarian stimulation will allow you to produce a collection of eggs. So your run-of-the-mill, healthy, average woman who's doing a stimulation might get anywhere from 12 to 20 eggs. The first patient population we're going into are women who have done a cycle and seen a poor response. So they're getting 0 eggs, 1 egg, 2 eggs, 3 eggs, some very small number. Maybe they've had a few cycles of that number. And what we can do when we use AMH as a pre-treatment, before you do that ovarian stimulation, is you synchronize a wave of follicles so that there's a greater number of the follicles ready at the same stage to be stimulated by that stimulation cycle. In a normal context, current standard of care, you start the stimulation cycle and you're stimulating the follicles that happen to be at the right stage to respond to those hormones. But at any given point in time, you have follicles at every stage of development. They're not generally developing synchronously. You have some that are early, the primordial ones, you have some that are late, you have many in the middle. You don't really know. We have no way of knowing what collection of follicles is where in development. So using AMH as a pretreatment essentially gives you a wave of synchronized follicles. And the last thing I'll say, because this is really difficult to, I think, describe, but also receive conceptually without any sort of visual aid. But I think one thing that's helpful to visualize, you can think of a garden hose that's turned on and water's flowing through, and you kind of bend it to put a kink in it. And when you put a kink in a hose, you stop the flow of water. When you release that kink, there's sort of a spurt that happens because water built up and then it resumes normal flow. This is essentially what's happening with the AMH treatment. You put a kink in there, and when you release treatment, you get a spurt. So you get a greater than typical wave of follicles that are able to move through their maturation at the same pace and time and development stage, so that you can capture it in the stimulation cycle and then ultimately get an increased number of eggs through one harvest. Hopefully, and ultimately reducing the number of cycles a woman might want or need to go through to get the number of eggs she needs to have a successful outcome.
Okay, that's really cool because we have a mechanism that could be used to extend reproductive longevity. But the indication that it sounds like you're pursuing is, for lack of a better word, just kind of run-of-the-mill fertility treatment.
Yeah.
Great. So what stage of development are you in?
We're currently in preclinical stage with this lead asset. Clinic is around the corner, so we're not far. I mean, the main pieces of work that we need to do now are really preparing the package for the FDA, but we have a lot of very robust and very exciting preclinical data across a wide variety of animal models now showing efficacy and safety in a non-formal context, I should say. When I say safety, we haven't yet done the formal FDA safety and tox studies. So yeah, it's very exciting because there's a lot of great data behind it validating the mechanism. We also know just generally that AMH is highly conserved. Its function is highly conserved across mammals, across species. And so from a translation standpoint, it's very well poised to be successful. And from a practical on the ground standpoint, we're now in the phase where we're checking the boxes to get ready to show the FDA we have something that's safe, that works, and looking to go into human first in human trials to test for safety in a human population.
This show is about aging, and so I want to move away from fertility for a second and go back to what we were talking about above. We were talking about menopause and its associated health risks. You've alluded to this and given us, I think, enough pieces to make a good guess about this. So tell us how an AMH-based therapy could help to delay menopause and why it might be valuable as a health span enhancing medication.
Yes, this is what I am most excited about for what we're doing. The fertility is a great indication to show proof of concept and safety and efficacy. But ultimately, what I really, my dream for this is to, as quickly and safely as possible, develop this as a therapeutic to give women a tool that they can manage their onset of menopause directly. How AMH could do that is by being given as a drug that essentially either is the AMH protein itself, which is our current lead asset, is the protein itself, or an agonist of that, something like a small molecule that activates that same pathway to preserve ovarian reserve. So we're slowing how quickly we lose eggs over time. And in doing so, being able to extend the runway to menopause. Now, why that matters for aging is that menopause is the single greatest accelerant of aging that is known in the world today. We know that once a woman enters menopause, her pace of aging is accelerated by some measures, 6%. I've seen some data with other higher figures, but I know that the 6% figure is from Steve Horvath's lab looking at the epigenetic clock in women pre and post menopause. And, you know, in addition to all of the negative health consequences that I already detailed, which really significantly impact quality of life for women and health span in women. We know women typically live longer than men, but they also spend a significantly increased number of years in poor health relative to men. And I think in the aging space in particular, you know, there's a lot of talk about longevity, but ultimately, most of the people that I respect most, they're really focused on how good is the life I'm living. Of course, it's nice to have more years, but if I'm going to live to over 100, I want to feel good. I want to be able to dance. I want to be able to taste and hear and sing and play. And if I can't do those things, you know, I don't need a few more years in a wheelchair where I can't see or hear anybody, you know? And so I think health span is utterly essential if we're looking to intervene on aging, really doing things that allow us to preserve health for as long as possible or restore health where health is lost. And this strategy is really centering that. And certainly my priority in the vision of Oviva, looking to give women agency by developing therapeutics that improve health span. So instead of going into menopause at 52, for example, which is the average onset of menopause for women in the US, being able to have a therapeutic intervention that extends that to a later date, whether that's 58 or 62 or 75 or indefinitely. And I can't give a number there because we just don't have data to illustrate what's possible or what consequences might occur as a result of this type of intervention. But of course, you know, we're all aware that hormone therapy exists. And so this is something that very much could be used in sequence with that, where you take an AMH-based therapeutic, your time to menopause gets further out. You enter menopause at a later date, hopefully with some degree of your choosing rather than it just happening to you. And as you are in that phase, then you can start your hormone therapy if that's appropriate for you. I'm not a medical doctor, so this is not advice, but I am a very big supporter and proponent of the use of hormone therapy to improve health span and actually longevity for women. So, you know, this is something that, because of the power of the mechanism, because there's such a restricted expression of the receptor, meaning that the likelihood of safety is much higher than for many of the other therapeutics out there today, which have lots of off-target effects because of the prevalence of receptor expression in different parts of the body, we don't really face that same thing. AMH is unique in that it has this powerful mechanism, but it also has very restricted expression. So its place of action is quite narrow and largely in the ovary. And I'm just very excited for the potential of this because I think it is arguably one of the most meaningful therapeutic strategies to over half of our population that we've ever developed. Every single woman will go through menopause if she lives long enough to do so. And we know that it negatively impacts health. So just like contraceptives gave women a lot of reproductive choice when they were delivered, this would give women choice over when, if, or how they might enter menopause. And I think that's something that would be hugely transformative, not just for health and longevity, but also economically to our culture, to the workplace, where we know women are leaving typically when they enter the menopausal transition. We're losing a lot of leadership. We're losing a lot of wisdom and, you know, just quality of life for that person and all of the satellite lives around them, whether that's their family or colleagues or communities.
I did not know that perimenopause and menopause was a time when women tended to leave the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes, it's true. A lot of women experience brain fog and anxiety. They can't perform at the same degree that they're accustomed to. There's such a culture of shame. They don't know how to talk about it or ask for help. It's something that's increasingly, there's an awareness that's building around it. There are more resources coming to light with that and more, you know, HR approaches and things of that nature. But it's basically, we all have gone through puberty, right? And that was disruptive for me. Your hormones are crazy and you're moody and men and women, right? Or boys and girls go through this.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And this is like that, you know, and actually I was at this really incredible conference this week of women entrepreneurs and CEOs and creatives. And many of the women were in perimenopause or menopause or postmenopausally. And one of them said to me in passing, she's like, you know, I think it's particularly cruel that many women are going through menopause at the same moment their teenagers are going through puberty. So the household is just a very volatile place. And, you know, I think that's a nice touch point that men can relate to, too. I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to even remember puberty, but we all have a concept of what puberty is for boys and girls. And it's not so different, except the fact that the stakes are high. You have many women have a career where they need to perform at a certain level. They feel the pressure to behave in certain ways and have the capacity for certain things. And we don't really have an infrastructure to support this transition, much less the innovation and in a therapeutic approach that can support this. And there's one more thing that I'd like to say there, if you don't mind me expanding a bit further.
Please, please. I had intended to devote the rest of the conversation to big picture stuff, but you're already there.
Good. Okay. So one thing that I think is I really want to highlight, because it's in, if you're in the women's health space, it's kind of in the conversation. And I think it's important to broaden that audience. There was a recent article a few weeks ago that came out in The Lancet, and it got picked up by a bunch of news outlets. And the headline that got picked up was around how we are currently over-medicalizing menopause. I couldn't disagree more with that. The people I respect in the space, Jen Garrison included, couldn't disagree more with that, because we know how significant the onset of menopause is to a person's health and well-being. Again, let alone their relationships and their participation in the workforce and the economic output of women and our contribution to the world, it's a health issue. And just the fact that it happens and it's quote unquote natural, a word that I generally don't like using, doesn't mean that we should accept it and not develop diagnoses and therapeutic strategies and interventional strategies, not to mention train our medical force to be able to care for and support women in something that is significantly impacting their health. And I can't tell you how irate I was when I first read this. And in part because I think the example that always comes to mind, it's a bit trite, but you know, no one says we over-medicalize erectile dysfunction. And the number of men that are afflicted with that is actually quite small. 100% of women go through menopause. They don't all experience the symptomology that's intense and disruptive, but most of them do. Between 70 and 80% are experiencing a lot of the most disruptive aspects of menopausal transition directly. And of course, then there's also the other impacts to health, which aren't as visible or tangible in the immediate day-to-day. So I think it's really important that people understand that, especially leaders, especially decision makers, especially more senior in their career, who are interacting with and developing policies that relate to women in that stage of their life. And I think what's cool is like, we're now at a place where we actually can create innovation that allows us to circumvent a lot of this issue in the first place. And that's obviously what we're trying to do at Oviva, and deeply passionate about that, as you can tell. And, you know, really excited to be able to share my perspective and the work that we're doing to that end.
Fantastic. You touched on something that reminded me that I wanted to give you the opportunity to give some background. Reproductive longevity is a phrase that I think certainly 10 years ago, I'd barely ever heard. And it's really in the past few years that I personally have encountered it as an emerging field with a lot of ferment and energy. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to give props to people you think deserve props, talk a little bit about the potential of the field, and maybe what kinds of key advances do you see happening in the next few years?
I'm going to half answer your question and half not answer your question.
Totally fine.
And I think what I'll say first to that is I think reproductive longevity as a field is really interesting. I don't really put us squarely in that field. And I certainly don't put my main driver in that field either, which is to say that I recognize I'm a 37-year-old woman. I just had a birthday. I'm 37.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And I recognize and experience the pressure that, especially in this moment of our lives and the way that our culture is set up, how hard it is to feel like you, if you want to have children, if you want to have or build a family, you have a finite amount of time. And every year you wait increases risks of bad things happening, essentially, or the likelihood that you might not be able to have children. That's extremely stressful. And I recognize that. I think it's a really important thing for us to address in a myriad of ways. That being said, I also think it's essential to highlight and underscore that women are so much more than their capacity to reproduce. And not all women want children, or many women don't want any more children if they have children. So I like to always give some words to the fact and breathe some life into the fact that what I hope most to achieve with what we're doing at Oviva is to improve the lives of all women who have ovaries, to increase the number of years of life spent in good health as a number one. For me, there's a number two that relates to specifically reproductive longevity, which is there a way that we can relieve that pressure on women to feel the need or have the need to reproduce at a certain window in their life in a way that's healthy? I think it's important because I get this question sometimes to underscore that my goal is not to allow women to have healthy pregnancies forever or to get pregnant, you know, when they're 55 or 60. We're still aging. So, and our eggs are still aging. And our therapeutic, to the strength of the data we have presently, we don't know how much it really influences egg quality positively. There's some evidence it does, but we're not reversing aging in the chromosomes of the eggs, which we know is a key driver of a decline in fertility for women as they age. And so I do want to recognize and highlight that that's not the goal, though there is a very strong possibility that if we're successful in our primary goal, that there is some positive influence on our ability to have less pressure to have children between the current window that's safe and effective for women. We still are going to hit the issue of after 35, you're having more likelihood of miscarriage. You're having more difficulty with pregnancy because your body is older. Your uterus is older. And that's important to convey. And I think important for the health of women as well, that like the older you are when you're pregnant, the more risks there are to your health directly. And of course, to the fetus and the baby. So that's, I think, important to say. That being said, reproductive longevity, I think, is really cool. There's also some interesting efforts around on the male side of things as well, because a lot of cases relating to fertility are male factor fertility. And that's a little bit less my wheelhouse. So I can't speak in great detail to the statistics and the data there, other than to know that it's much more than we typically acknowledge and give credit for, that obviously both men and women contribute to the fertility issue at hand. It's just more, it feels more acute for women because it is. And to that end, I think it's exciting that we are doing more research to understand what are the key factors that drive both fertility and infertility. I think what's also really exciting is that there's a growing awareness that fertility is a marker of health and well-being. And so to the degree that we can preserve and extend fertility, we're also generally preserving and extending health and well-being. They track. When you're in an unhealthy state or highly stressed or really not doing well, generally your fertility plummets. And if you can have a restoration of health after that, that will also come back. And many women have experienced that and know that firsthand. You said give props. We've already said Jen's name a few times, but I think Jennifer Garrison is just somebody that I really admire and respect, and I think has done a lot for our field broadly across women's health. She, of course, is the founder and director of the Global Consortium for Reproductive Longevity and Equality. I think soon to be named Productive Science or something like that. They have a cool rebrand coming in the next couple of months.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, she's been a person who's really created a community and a convening of people dedicated to this space to help it become more cohesive and collaborative and infuse capital into it as well and build awareness. You know, she's always on the road traveling, doing podcasts, giving interviews, talking at conferences. And I just, you know, I always think of her as like the superstar in this field. And I'm grateful to call her a friend and, you know, mentor in many ways. So I think what she's doing is excellent. I also, interestingly, when I think about giving props to people, then I think about all the menopause people, which is really not reproductive longevity. of course,
as you pointed out, Daisy, and I think that's so important. I mean, I led into this most recent answer of yours with a question about reproductive longevity, and you've really helped me through your answer clarify my thinking on this. Like, this is not primarily and solely, certainly not solely, and not even primarily, a reproductive longevity play. It is a women's health play.
Absolutely. And I do think that extends indirectly to the health of our families and partners. And we're both of an age where we know people or we are directly involved in caretaking of elder people. Mm-hmm. And women are generally that person. And they're doing it at a moment in their lives when they're really suffering. And so I think supporting the health of women is just so supportive of the cohesion of our communities and society in a way that's really hard to make tangible, but I think will be felt when we really start giving it some attention.
Thank you so much for that additional thought-provoking statement. I feel like I've learned so much from our conversation. Dr. Daisy Robinson, CEO and co-founder of Aviva Therapeutics, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to be here.
I think I speak for our entire audience when I wish you good luck and Godspeed with everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
Many thanks as well to our listeners and subscribers. If you have feedback or suggestions for future episodes of Translating Aging, you can contact us by email at podcast@bioagelabs.com, on Twitter @BioAgePodcast, or via our LinkedIn page. You can also follow our sponsor, BioAge Labs, on Twitter and LinkedIn. We'll see you next time.